I thought it was an interesting theme, or it was so wonderful to bring that subject up, because I realized that there seems to be some kind, for me, in my experience, some kind of how can I say? If we look at the what we have at hand, the things that we recite, if we look at the expressions of the things we, you know, we chant, and it's never really said clearly. The word rarely comes up in these texts. I mean, if we look at the I was looking this morning at the three tenets of the Zen peacemakers, for example. Oh, actually, that's a bad example, but like the precepts that we receive when we take Jukai, you know, non-stealing, non-lying, not talking about others' errors, faults and errors, not being stingy with the Dharma and all that. Doesn't really say out loud anything about love. The Bodhisattva vows that we recite every day. Again, it's not being said explicitly. And when we practice koans, again, it's not mentioned explicitly. When we think about the Zen tradition in Asia, it doesn't strike us as the probably the first word that comes up is not love. So I was wondering what to make out of that, and how does it relate to my experience also? How do I see that? And if I go back to my experience, I don't need to go really far, actually. My first encounter really with a Buddhist teacher with whom I had a personal relationship was Lama Surya Das, an American teacher in the Tibetan tradition, trained in France. I didn't know anything about Buddhism, and he didn't talk to me about Buddhism. But I could feel that, I could sense that quality of boundless love and not being judgmental, and this quality of being in the world, which was very special to me when I met him and I was 17. Then I went to Dhamma Sangha, and if I the first kind of memory that comes up, it's not even a memory, a sense, the feeling was the quality of the of what was coming out of Gen Roshi. The Yes, the love again, the quality of intimacy with herself and others. That was really striking. And this is, I kind of have that, it's not a precise memory, but I kind of have that sense of being in the Zendo and feeling that quality. And again, with Amy Roshi, I can feel that. So if I kind of step back, I suddenly was a little bit puzzled by how these two pictures didn't seem to fit from the first look. And yet, it's always there. It pervades everywhere, I feel. If we look closely at what we sing, if we look closely at the precepts that we're taking. We have all kinds of tools, including meditation, in order to practice, to cultivate certain qualities and to practice to strip ourselves from certain conditioning, from our conditionings that inhibits, forbids us to live freely. We have guidelines in order to, sometimes they're helpful. I find the precepts very helpful at times, and in times of difficulties, going back to that and feel maybe there's one aspect there that I need to look at. Right now I'm in a house where there are a lot of mosquitoes. So the precepts are like, yeah, what am I going to do with the killing and non-killing about the mosquitoes? Right. That's sometimes that it's a little help, a reminder. So we have ethical guidelines with the Eightfold Path. We have vows that allows us to express our deepest intentions. We take refuge in the Buddha, in the Dharma, in the Sangha. And what came up for me was that these were skillful means in order to manifest that love. We are able to manifest that love because we're cultivating this Eightfold Path, these ethical guidelines. We are integrating it. We're trying to live up to that. I mean, we have that fourth line of the Bodhisattva vows that we recite, which is a little bit enigmatic. the Buddha way is unsurpassable, I vow to embody it. What is that? What do we embody really? I mean, it doesn't really say. We have to go back to other texts or other, what do we embody? What are we embodying in that, at that moment? What are we trying to embody? This week I've stumbled into a quote from a poet called Margaret Gibson. I didn't know her. And she wrote something that really touched me and that kind of linked to that subject of love. And what we're practicing. She wrote, "Faced with so much that is impossible to understand, standing right at the edge of mortality of everything that we know and are and may come to be, what else can we do but create, make something, make it with love and clarity? Make it out of desperation that turns into tenderness. Making it out of the deepest part of ourselves, present everywhere and nowhere." And that line of making it out of desperation that turns into tenderness, that really, it really struck me when I read that phrase. That really struck me as the experience of, as we say in Buddhism, in dukkha, the existential angst, the unsatisfactoriness of life, and what we're trying to make out of that, and that path, that Buddhist path, is really a path that tries to create something, a creative response that leads to tenderness. I like that word, tenderness. Love is very grandiose, and tenderness has that, or friendliness, or that this movement of the heart. And I feel that all that practice leads us to this path of love, or leads to this path of tenderness. And I'm wondering if it's not said out loud or in a very obvious way, because if I look at my experience, I was very stuck with myself and very stuck with my conditioning and very stuck with my own suffering. So, I don't know if that would have spoken to me right away. I know that in certain tradition, in Tibetan tradition, the metta practices, the practices of on love and compassion is something that's very out there. But we don't do that as much, or in that way. So I feel we have practices of cultivation, certain qualities, and we have that path that we are engaged in, which is a path of love, and that I feel is can really be manifested if we are able also to let go of certain things and let go of ideas about ourselves and be connected, be intimate with ourselves, and be friendly towards ourselves. I mean, all these things that are expressed in the Eightfold Path, that sustains that ability to walk on that path. I really find the distinction very helpful between the practice and the path. We have all kinds of practices, but what is our path? This path is sustained with our intentions, with ethical guidelines, but what are we walking on? And I personally feel that sometimes it can be, I could easily get carried away by some other aspects, dimensions of the practice. You know, carried away by the forms, carried away by my desire to understand better this tradition, to delve into concepts. And yet, I keep reminding myself that this intellectual work, for example, is at the service of love and the first vow, Bodhisattva, that we recite is sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them all. In the version, in the translation of the Zen peacemaker, it's numberless beings I vow to serve them. I mean, that dimension of service or saving or can truly happen if it's a manifestation of love. And I think we could look at all the other vows that perspective. The precepts, the Eightfold Path, ethical guidelines in order to help us to manifest that love that is in us. And I treasure very much the moments shared within the context of a sangha, of a Buddhist sangha, Wildflower, when I go to Dana Sangha, or when I go to other sanghas in the world, where you can feel, experience this dimension of love, this dimension of this quality of relationships, grounded in our practice, grounded in our intentions, grounded in this movement of being engaged in that path. It's always so touching, and it's always, not only it's touching, but it's also where it's being manifested, where we can experience it, and when we can learn from it. And expand also from it. Because I realize, I always have that experience that I might have, an experience of love towards a partner, towards sangha members, and then you go out in the street and someone says something, and suddenly all these things that you seem to have practiced seems to don't seem to exist anymore. And we fall back into our habitual patterns, our conditionings. And we have to look at that all over again and use that creatively. Again, use that our encounter with reality in a creative way, so that we can deepen this path of love. It feels as if there is a we are learning ourselves to strip down unveil, unwrap what has been, what we've, this conditioning that took place over the years that we're learning to unlearn or untide or something like that, in order to let this primal source spring. So there's a paradox. There is something to learn, and at the same time it is very simple, and yet it's very difficult to, it seems very complicated for us to be simple about it. And all these tools, all these skillful means, all these precepts and rituals and all that are all leverages. In order to tap into into that love. It really touches me to think of the of Shakyamuni as he apparently lived in difficult situation, in a difficult time, tried to make the best out of it, and the whole this whole community that he built, it was something about relationships. Was something about how to live together in a harmonious way. And I found that very touching, that it's there is an element of it's all about relationships. And that tenderness. Yeah. I like that word, tenderness. So so I guess this is really just what I wanted to say today. The how even if it's doesn't seem that obvious when we look at all these texts and all these forms, it's this love is actually the path that is shown. And maybe Western teachers do a better job at making it explicit than what the texts actually say sometimes. And I'm really grateful that Roshi brought that up and made it clear. And that all the teachers that I've met in our lineage, I mean, this goes back to the fourth line of the Bodhisattva vows, manifesting, unsurpassable. The Buddha was unsurpassable. I vow to embody it, embodying it, embodying that quality of that love, that tenderness towards ourselves and others. I guess I would be happy to exchange and hear. That subject or any other subjects. So if you want to say something, you have this raising hand function somewhere. I'm not sure where it is, but I have a question. I have a question from Hugo saying, is that conditioning a bad thing? Or are we trying to see it, embody it as the mud that allows the lotus to flower? What are we embodying? What are we embody it? Ourselves maybe embody who we are with all our aspects, including shadows, maybe. Noni. Oh, sorry. Is that conditioning a bad thing? Well, it reminds me, you know, the question that was asked, you know, does the Buddha, what is it about the karma? The embodiment, the conditioning, there's a conditioning anyway. We are conditioned. And we need to realize how that creates, that pushes us in directions that don't allow us to be free and don't allow us to experience reality freely. Should maybe when we get into this bad or bad or right or wrong, we're getting into maybe getting stuck, and maybe a creative response would be just observe what conditioning is producing, and is it producing wholesome consequences for our lives, for ourselves, or unwholesome consequences? And what do I want? And what we want to embody is really up to us, I would say. It's really like a question that we need to ask ourselves. What do we want to embody? What do we want for ourselves? And this is like, this is a crucial, crucial question. Looking at our intentions, and I find very useful, especially if I fall into drowsiness in meditation. What am I doing here? What is it that I want? What is it that I want to cultivate? What is my path? What am I practicing? I find this is a crucial question that we need to ask, that we can ask ourselves, and see how we, depending on how we respond to that, to act accordingly. And yeah, about the shadow, I found that it's really interesting. I'm always aware that there might be a blind spot, something that I'm not seeing. So how am I seeing something that I'm not seeing? Speaking a 21st century language is like also, you know, unconscious aspects of my intentions, for example. How do we turn our heads so that we see that blind spot that we're not, that we can't see by definition? And I find it's really hard. I find this is what helps is again, going back to our intentions, looking also, I mean, the relationship with the teacher helps also. The Sangha is also, can also act as a mirror. So that helps us to see in corners that we can't really see. And I find that really useful. Paying attention to what others are saying about ourselves. Clues. People give us clues, but we don't necessarily pay attention. So paying attention to these clues, and that may help us broaden our perspectives about ourselves and our understanding. Debbie, I didn't see that.
First of all, Joe, I wanted to thank you for broaching this delicate subject. Amy Roshi started the other night. And for me, one of the attractions of Zen is that there is no direct discussion with the word love in it. Because it, as an American especially, this can quickly turn into Hallmark card material. When I, years ago, before I got involved in Buddhism, I looked into evangelical Christian movements. I grossed out on love. It was just a bit too much. Everybody blessing me and loving me, and I was over adulated. So when my first approach to Zen was, I liked the sobriety. It was a little bit cold, but at least it wasn't gushy. And then, as you say, with many different people in the sanghas, a relationship unlike any other relationship in the world grows up. And then you don't have to use any gushy words, but you know what you're talking about. So it's although the first time Amy started a couple of Thursdays ago, I thought, oh, here we go. Oh, no, love, that tacky subject. The other thing I'd like to thank you for, even before today, because you've done it several times, and for me it was kind of a taboo. It came up in the text study in Ghana, is this business about intentions. Because I always often thought that Zen, to be Zen, you're not supposed to have an intention. You're supposed to be open to no intention. And you can get really kind of lost in Nowhereville if when you're sitting, you don't, as you say, ask me, what am I doing here? Well, I don't have an intention. Well, then what are you doing here? Why don't we go do the dishes or get something done? It's very funny because I wrote to myself again this morning, Frank Roshi for years kept saying the same thing, only I heard something different. In the land of truth, I thought he said there is no map. But in fact, he said, in the land of truth, there is no path. And that intrigues and worries me at the same time. Thank you, Joa.
Yeah, thank you, Debbie. I think there's the another distinction that can be useful is having intentions and having goals. If we get trapped with goals because we want success, or then we are confronted with failure, whereas our intentions is it's right now. And yeah, and it's maybe sometimes it is, at least that's what you express. It might be a good thing for some people that love is, I guess also for me, that was an attraction, the simplicity of it. And I kind of get into the metta practices right now, but I think I was annoyed by it earlier on. And I think I wasn't ready for it because I was too wrapped up in myself, and I think as you, I would have, it was like a pull off to hear these nice things, love, and I think it's also interesting that Bernie changed loving action to taking action that arises from not knowing and bearing witness, instead of saying loving action, because again, that gives this. And this is why I feel that maybe tenderness is in between, or friendliness. I like very much also the term friendliness, because being friendly towards oneself, or loving some, it's less heavy, and maybe it's less frightening. I'm fine. Thank you. Thiago?
Thanks. Fantastic to hear you talk about the vows again. it struck me as you're saying, the sentient beings are numberless. I vow to love them could be a replacement word, and or be friends with them, or be tender with them. And in fact, it resonated with me that you could actually replace every single vow with love. So the delusions are numberless. I vow to be friends with them. Instead of when I hear put an end to them, it's almost like getting rid of them, and it's not exactly that. So, and this is also very present because we've tried to translate them into Portuguese and other verses we chant, and in doing so, it made me personally look very deeply into them, and to see how the words, what the words mean, what the flavors are, because they are different in different languages. Mm. So it was very interesting to hear you talk about them, and before, some weeks ago as well. Mm. And yeah, I when you started to talk about saying that we don't talk about love explicitly very often, yeah, it resonates with me quite a lot. And there was something when you say that you felt in the beginning that you were very self-centered, or not self-centered, just looking at your own suffering, and you couldn't see the rest of the world suffering. It's good to hear that, because I think I'm in that point at that point still. So yeah, I just want to say thank you. It was very good to hear you talk. Thank you.
Thank you, Thiago. Seu?
I only want to say it's not so easy for me to speak in English, but I only want to say that you said we learn to strip ourselves, and I want to say that at the beginning, when you begin to give Dharma talks, for me it was so complicated to follow you, and at the moment I follow you very well, and it's I want to say that only. Okay.
Thank you, Sue. So it's almost one. I'd just like to say one last thing. Two things, actually. It's like it's wonderful to see so many of you, and that we can share that practice together. And I'm very grateful for what happened with the COVID and that it allowed us to mingle that way, and also to see that the people in Paris and get to see people in Portugal and other places, and I found that really wonderful. Christine just has. Christine, you want to say something just before we?
Yeah, it won't take long.
Yeah.
It just made me think of, it's the first time that I hear you giving a talk, and it made me think of when I came to this practice in 2006, that you were already there.
Yeah.
It was in your, so yeah, just kind of touching, you know, we really walked this path together. I just wanted to share that it's great to have this practice. Mm. And that for so many years, we're practicing together. So thank you.
Yes, and thank you, Christine. That ties up with the second thing I wanted to say is that Roshi has been at our service really for a long time, and we decided to do this this retreat based on dana, based on just free donation. And think of it. Think of how what it means to you, you know, what it means to be able to meet that way and to be helped in that practice that way by a teacher, by the Sangha, by what is being done. And it's done out of love, and I know that. Think of the practice of dana is we haven't personally in Wildflower we haven't used it frequently. In other traditions they do that in a more frequently, more systematically. But I think it's a great practice to reflect. To use, you know, another skillful mean. What does it mean? What do I do? How do I interact? What do I put in the basket? So just consider that. Consider that practice of dana. So thank you very much for sharing this moment all together, and we will. We'll see each other tonight.